This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we talk about our favorite trashy movies. Everybody's got one. But now we're in the second week of the first major Hollywood writer's strike since 2007. And the rise of streaming platforms is being assailed by the Writers Guild of America, and they argue that the studios have not increased their compensation appropriately. We're going to dip into the organized labor side of this first, and then we'll talk about the impacts on what you can and can't see on TV and in the movies, now and going forward. And you can join the conversation if you like. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Michael Childers is a professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He's an expert in labor unions, collective bargaining, production standards, and labor management relations in union environments. I spoke with him earlier this afternoon. Let's start with how the ways in which we watch TV and movies have changed, obviously. But how has that changed the livings of the people who are making it, Michael?
That's a great question because it has fundamentally impacted them. When you look back at the last time that this union ended up having to strike during their negotiations, DVD sales were a huge thing, which, of course, now don't even exist. Structurally, streaming has remade basically all parts of the entertainment industry, and for writers, it's no different. And a big point of contention and something that needs to yet be worked out is exactly how compensation works in terms of the royalties that they are able to earn for shows that they've already worked on.
Well, one of the ongoing themes I think I've seen in the stories I've read is that these writers seem to be employed less often and finding jobs can be more difficult than it used to be. So how do they compensate that and find a way to make a living with what they're doing?
That again, is a result of sort of the change in the dynamic in terms of how shows are being sourced and produced. When you think about traditionally network series, you're talking about 20 to 24 episodes per season. So once a writer was in a writing room on one of these major shows, they pretty much knew they had 40 plus weeks worth of work lined up for the year. If you think about some of the more popular streaming series, they can be as little as 4 to maybe 12 episodes per season, which means that, yeah, in a real sense, writers have to scramble kind of gig to gig, because even if they do land these positions and are in these writing rooms, it doesn't even last a calendar year.
So Michael Childers, our guest, professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. You mentioned the previous strike, 2007, 15 years ago. It lasted 100 days. From what you've seen so far, could we see this one last as long or if not longer?
Of course, anything's possible, and you hate to prognosticate. But I would say that it seems that both sides are fairly entrenched in their positions, and the writers are bringing up issues around artificial intelligence, for example, that have yet to really be negotiated in a major national contract. So unfortunately, yes, right now I know people understand, obviously, the immediate impacts. But if it drags on, your possible outcome could be, the delay of fall programming.
What's the concerns over artificial intelligence and what it could mean for content creators?
Well, that's one of really the two major points that are remaining. And I guess I would say it this way. In general, workers are always concerned about being replaced, whether you're working in a factory or at a fast food restaurant, right? And the writers are no different, and they really see the large language model AI as a potential threat in terms of, what it means to their future livelihood. And what they're asking for basically is some very stringent constraints on how and where this technology can be used in their profession.
Who's in a better position to weather this labor dispute and this ongoing strike? Would it be the writers themselves or would it be the studios?
Well, it's pretty easy to do the math and figure out who has more money. So from that perspective, obviously, I mean, the studios, especially, and it's kind of ironic, it's the streaming services that are probably best positioned for a longer holdout, in that they have a lot more shows in the can, so to speak. They have a lot more programming that's already been created that they can continue to, met out as they need to try and keep you know, things fresh. They don't have to go straight to reruns, right? At the same time, I think the writers are very determined to try and get some concessions around both, you know, like we talked about, the AI, and also around the size of writer rooms and when they can use these so-called mini rooms for show development. So it could be a protracted struggle.
Would you explain the mini rooms for us a little bit, Professor Childers?
Sure. And now we're getting into really the inside baseball. But basically, in the past, producers or showrunners have utilized what they call quote unquote mini rooms, where it's just a handful of writers who are perhaps like typically was used like for a show that's under development, where maybe they haven't ordered the actual series yet, but they want to create a pilot, maybe the first couple of episodes, just to try and pitch it. And more, the studios are saying, well, yeah, this model seems to be great, so we'll employ less people for a shorter time. And yeah, that's something that the writers are pushing back on. We were talking about the last contract. Back then, I mean, one of the things they negotiate for is sort of like a minimum pay structure, a minimum salary scale. And back at the last strike, about a third of the writers would come in and be making at the minimum scale. And now it's up to half. So it kind of gives you the sense for how much things have changed for them.
Yeah. Michael Childers, our guest, professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. And what are some of the reverberations we've seen so far in the TV and movie industry? And are there other unions that are stepping up to support the Writers Guild of America?
Yeah, I think absolutely all the other entertainment industry unions have stepped up. I mean, I've heard of instances where, for example, the Teamsters, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, who we traditionally think of as like truck drivers, bus drivers, that sort of thing, they refused to cross picket lines. So in places where the writers have set up pickets, the Teamster drivers have refused to make deliveries. There's definitely a lot at stake in terms of both for the producers, because the next two contracts that are going to be up that they're going to have to be negotiating are both with the Directors Union and also with SAG-AFTRA, which is sort of your on-screen talent. So obviously, they're watching with close attention and obviously trying to offer their support, because they understand that they're going to soon be in bargaining as well.
Yeah, I saw a video of Mandy Patinkin at the picket lines yesterday, and he had a Princess Bride sign, "You killed residuals, prepare to pay." And he was joined by Bob Odenkirk, who at one point was one of the writers, but probably know him best as Saul Goodman from Better Call Saul. So this plays out in a much bigger picture going forward. What are some of the things that you're watching for next, Michael?
Well, again, I think from a labor relations perspective, it's interesting to see how they're able or what they're able to work out in terms of a resolution to the AI question, because this is something that's on a lot of people's minds. And obviously, you know, what the writers are able to achieve is going to have impact that's going to be watched closely.
And what can I do, or what can a consumer do as part of this labor dispute? Is there a way to, are we in danger of crossing a picket line by streaming, or is there a way to support the writers?
I mean, again, I think the writers, I mean, I think a lot of people are following this on social media just because they're interested in what's developing or how things are going. I mean, in terms of actual solidarity, I'm guessing they probably have websites, et cetera, set up to assist writers, especially if the strike drags out longer, in terms of mutual aid and support. So,
could this be a moment where artificial intelligence does step in and start generating content for us to consume?
Well, I think we've seen already examples that it is being used, right, in terms of advertising. I know there was an article this year about a famous Formula One driver who had an article that said it was an interview of him that was in a magazine. And he said, yeah, that's impossible because I've never spoken with you folks. And they later fessed up, well, yeah, it was generated by AI. So it's happening now. It's just about the ways in which it's going to be regulated and constrained.
Michael Childers, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's always a pleasure to be on Central Time.
Michael Childers is professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, and I talked with him earlier this afternoon about the labor union aspect of this ongoing Hollywood writer's strike. Next, we'll hear from an entertainment reporter about how this is affecting TV and movies, and you and me, the consumers. And you can join us now over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the strike is affecting the writers themselves and us, the media consumers? Are you paying close attention to the shows and movies that might be affected by it? How's it affecting you? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the Writers Guild of America strike now in its second week. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You understand where the writers are coming from and their need for more support from the entertainment industry? Joining us now to talk more specifically about the impact on the entertainment industry is Wendy Lee. Wendy's an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times, where she covers streaming services like Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Apple TV. And Wendy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank you for sticking around and listening to our conversation with Michael Childers from the UW-Madison. And I wondered what you'd have to add in terms of what you're covering and what you heard from the professor there.
Well, I think that one thing also important to note is, in addition to the writers that are being affected by this, and is also that the impact of the strike is also affecting small businesses. Small businesses like prop houses, florists, caterers, businesses that, you know, supply services to some of these productions, and when they shut down, it can adversely affect the local economy also in the L.A. area.
Yeah. How much of L.A. is an industry town? How much of the economy there is dependent on the entertainment industry?
It's a lot. You know, I mean, hence the team that I'm on. It's called Company Town because we cover the entertainment industry. But yeah, I mean, they're, you know, I talked to some businesses last week, and some of them, like the majority of their revenue comes from serving these productions. And when they shut down, they, you know, they have to dip into their savings, or some of the small businesses are pivoting to live events. So, you know, so there is also a local economic impact.
The other thing that Professor Childers mentioned was the contracts for SAG-AFTRA and the Directors Union, and how what's happening now may bleed into or have some impact on what's to come with those negotiations. What are you seeing, Wendy?
Yeah, so my colleague, Anusha, she has reported on the DGA negotiations and Directors Guild of America negotiations. And I think historically, the Director Guild historically, the DGA has been able to come to an agreement with the studios. And so people are looking to the DGA to see what happens with those negotiations and how those might affect the negotiations with the writers and the studios.
Wendy, you have a recent piece in the LA Times focusing on the particular ire being targeted at Netflix. Why? What is it about Netflix specifically that has so many writers being critical of and part of this writer's strike?
Well, you know, I think that Netflix is seen as a pioneer streaming. And, you know, you have to think back to the last time when there was a writer's strike. That was 2007. And back then, Netflix was, you know, a business mailing DVDs, you know, but today Netflix is known as being this pioneer streaming that has a huge library of content. And with that, you know, when Netflix was building up its business, one of the things that Netflix offered to writers was it was seen as a leader in terms of this effort of greenlighting scripts to series without having to go through a pilot process. And in return, you know, Netflix had planned to keep all these shows and later movies exclusively on its platform for its originals. But, you know, because it was all on its platform, those shows and movies, you know, wouldn't be available anywhere else. So, for example, Bridgerton, the only place you can watch Bridgerton is on Netflix. But in the past, other shows that have become successful, you know, they get syndicated, And as it gets syndicated and as they air on other platforms, the talent would get a portion of those revenues. But those deals were structured differently when it came to streaming services. And so because of that, there is some concern from the writers targeting Netflix because they see Netflix as a leader of these deals that that have caused them concern for how they are compensated.
How real is a concern that artificial intelligence will be displacing actual writers in the writer room?
You know, I mean, I think that a lot of people are concerned about AI. I mean, even in the journalism industry, you know, there's conversations about what AI could do, you know, in terms of impacting writers. But I think it's kind of like, you know, it's a piece of technology that I think is important for people to talk about. I mean, on one hand, you know, there are some aspects of AI that I have heard from others that can be helpful in terms of idea generation, in terms of such as just making tasks a little bit easier, you know, in terms of our everyday lives. But of course, you know, that raises other concerns about, you know, what impact that will do for existing jobs. And I think it remains an open question.
Wendy Lee, our guest reporter for the LA Times, taking a look at the writer's strike, the first since 2007, and what that means for the entertainment industry. And you can join us with your questions and comments about what you might be missing or what you're wondering about this strike at 1-800-642-1234. I say that the first thing we've noticed, at least from the entertainment consumption side, Wendy, is the late night shows, the late night talk shows, almost instantaneously. Once the strike began, we're off the air or in reruns. What are some of the other implications for people like me who like to sit down and stream at the end of the day?
Well, I think that most consumers that have streaming services probably won't feel the impact of the strike right away. I mean, we are seeing some shows that were in production that did not have finished scripts shut down, such as season 6 of Cobra Kai on Netflix or the 5th season of Stranger Things. But those are shows that, you know, that were scheduled to go on the platform much farther on into the future. So I think like for everyday consumers, a lot of the libraries of the streaming services are so huge that I think there's so many shows that even me personally as a consumer that I follow, I still just don't have enough time to finish yet. Like I'm still trying to catch up on Picard. I'm trying to catch up on Mandalorian. And then even most recently, like I'm also discovering new shows like Doogie Kamehameha MD on Disney Plus. Like that show released in 2021, but I just saw it like in the library, you know, my Disney Plus content library, and I just started watching that. So I'm not sure if you know, I would think that consumers it'll be a while, like for those streaming services to feel it.
For me, it was the second season of Severance on Apple TV Plus that wanted me to find resolution to the writer's strike as quickly as possible.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure the severance of writers appreciate that.
Well, I'm just interested in what happens next, and there is a lot of that. But what about broadcast television? And a lot of these broadcast TVs now have their own streaming services. But is there concerns over fall lineups and when those might be impacted?
Yeah, no, I think that if this is a, you know, an extended strike, you know, I think that certainly the networks would be impacted. Most of the people that I talk to currently, they are hoping, although, you know, this is just a prediction. No one really knows exactly when the strike is going to end. But I think some of the people that I've talked to think that maybe it might end by, you know, the summer or by like August, I've heard.
Okay.
But as I said, like no one fully knows exactly when it will end, but it's possible that it might not, the strike might not be as long as the 2007, 2008 strike.
Which was about 100 days, if I remember correctly. But
Yes.
another
Yeah.
thing about that strike, Wendy Lee, was that it seemed to create a vacuum with reality television entering into it. Is this strike affecting our Real Housewives or Below Decks or other reality binge watching?
You know, I was talking with one of the industry analysts about this, and He pointed out that, say for streaming services like Netflix, Netflix over the years has already increased its unscripted shows. So to this industry analyst I talked to, he didn't anticipate like a widespread increase like in that category because the platforms already have invested in that category. But I mean, certainly that's an option, for these companies to do unscripted. And I think yeah, unscripted, is definitely a possibility for them. I think also, for the studios, one thing that they may also be looking at, according to some analysts I've talked to, is possibly getting, out of overall deals with writers, as in case the labor, in case the work stoppage lasts for a long time, which would result in some form of cost savings to the studios.
Got about a minute left, Wendy, but what are you watching for next in this ongoing strike story?
I think that, a lot of people are going to be watching the negotiations between the studios and the DGA. And I think also just what happens with overall writer deals. I mean, we are hearing about, studios suspending some of these deals. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with that as well.
Wendy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Wendy Lee is an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times. We talked to her today about the entertainment industry's impact in the ongoing Writers Guild of America strike. And earlier, we spoke with Michael Childers, professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, about the labor implications of this strike. And you can still comment online at ideas at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, what makes poverty in America so persistent? Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of Poverty by America, Matthew Desmond, and invites you to share your stories. Also, prisoners in China are allegedly being forced to make work gloves for a subcontractor of Milwaukee Tool. We'll get the latest from the Milwaukee Watch journalist behind this investigation. It's all coming up tomorrow morning with Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. That's from 7 to 9, right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A Plus, with near total abortion bans in 12 states, including our own, Jen White investigates the legal risks faced by those who facilitate access to abortions across state lines. Now, do you have a guilty pleasure when it comes to movies? That film that you love, even though you know it's bad, low budget, poorly acted, all of that? Many people found a new favorite in February when the movie Cocaine Bear debuted to moderate box office success.
There's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I told you there was.
Why is it acting like this? Did you feed it cocaine?
No, but you're safe. Bears can't climb trees.
Of course they can.
Then why are you up here?
Oh my, as the title suggests, the movie's about a bear that ingests cocaine and goes on a rampage. A dramatization of a real news story about a bear that died after eating a duffel bag's worth in the 1980s. It might not have been a very complex plot, but the $35 million project brought in over $23 million on its opening weekend, not far behind Marvel's big Ant-Man sequel. It's the latest example of an absurd low-budget movie seeing mainstream success, something that has been an important part of the Hollywood ecosystem for decades. We want to hear what you think and hear your favorite trashy movies. You can email us, WPRideas@WPR.org. Jocelyn Sepeniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called, you guessed it, Trash Cinema. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. I talked with her in March. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Thanks so much for having me on. I love talking about trash.
Good, because we've got a list here, but it starts with the latest, and that would be the popularity of Cocaine Bear. What do you think about it? How does it compare to the rest of the trash cinema genre?
Well, clearly audiences are really looking for something escapist, right? When we want to go see a movie called Cocaine Bear, it's kind of funny because although Cocaine Bear has this image as a trashy movie, it actually kind of had a big budget, not a big budget for a movie produced terribly recently, but $35 million, that's pretty significant. So it's kind of funny to look at that film in particular as a trash movie, because a lot of trash movies, they're really on the fringes.
Yeah, so what makes a movie, in your opinion, Jocelyn, so bad that it becomes good, or so trashy that it needs to be watched?
Well, I often tell my students there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's just pleasure. So I don't think we really need to feel bad about most of the things that we enjoy or most of the things that we're interested in. And as a matter of fact, this kind of trashy, low-budget cinema, it is completely entwined with the entire history of cinema. If we look all the way back into the 1920s, 1930s, very, very early 1930s, there's a practice called exploitation cinema. We hear that term and we think, oh, that must mean people being exploited, which is actually not what it means at all. It means the kind of, well, there's a few different opinions as to where the term comes from, but it comes from the idea of using advertising, which was called exploitation at that time. So really doing a lot of gimmicky advertising, kind of similar to actually what we would see with Cocaine Bear, right? Like lots of sort of gimmicks and like high profile advertising around it that's designed to get people into the theater.
Yeah, and Cocaine Bear seems to be part of a modern trend opting for some ridiculous plots involving fantastical creatures. The one that comes to mind here is the Sharknado. It's not even one. It's an entire series. It's a genre unto itself of sharks falling from the sky. It goes back to, I think, 2013. Here's a clip from the original Sharknado.
Every time it rains in L.A., everyone swears it's the storm of the century. And even if it is, Beverly Hills emergency services are second to none. We're safe here.
There are sharks flooding the streets. And now there's one swimming in your pool.
Are you kidding? Sharks in the swimming pool is impossible.
Well, I think you can guess how that ends. Now, Sharknado, never on the big, big screen, made for TV, but how much does the medium play a role in how these movies are received, Jocelyn?
The medium plays an enormous role. So to go back to, of course, I'm a historian, so I'm going to talk about the history
yes.
of foul movies and trashy movies. Going back to the moment of exploitation cinema, which I mean, it's just wonderful. If you want to see wild movies, Sharknado is one thing, but try watching Dwayne Esper's Maniac from 1934 if you want to see something truly outrageous. I mean, that movie has actual cats fighting next to women fighting, right? So it's like an actual, you know, doubled cat fight that happens on screen. It's just remarkable. But that moment in time, you know, exploitation films, they wouldn't be shown in your traditional fancy, nice downtown theaters. They'd be shown with a practice called four-walling, where the directors and producers would rent out a theater for the night or for a couple nights. They might show even in like carnival tents at the edges of town. And this kind of points to then a long history of bad or trashy or outlandish or just plain tasteless movies being shown in theaters that are like on the wrong side of the tracks, right? They're a little bit vice-ridden, a little bit outré, and that actually just adds to the mystique of seeing something that's a little bit verboten, right? And then we just like want to see it because it's in this kind of like, ooh, this slightly dirty place. Now I really want to see this trashy movie.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Lees, associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, who actually teaches a class in trashy movies. So you're talking to the expert here. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, good afternoon. You got a trashy movie for us?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I was calling for a couple of things. I wanted to give a mention to some of the schlockiest cinema of the 60s and 70s with some of the black exploitation movies, as well as the, I can't remember the name now, but like the Toxic Avenger. And some of those films.
Sure.
And then you already mentioned Sharknado. Some of the sequels to that are even more absurd. And then in my experience, I found that if a movie is a little more self-aware of the fact that it's very bad, it's more enjoyable often.
No, oh, I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you for the call. Sharknado, not just the original, but the sequels. And there were some spin-offs, too, as I understand it. But let's talk first about the blaxploitation films. Where does that fit in the trashy film discussion, Jocelyn?
Oh, I'm so glad that Michael brought those up because they're such fascinating documents. First of all, they're like every movie, right? But especially like trashy movies or lower budget movies, blaxploitation movies are really a time capsule, right? So if you're seeing these lower budget movies, especially from the 50s, 60s, or the high point of blaxploitation, which is in the 70s, the people making them didn't have a ton of money for set dressing necessarily, right? So you get a lot of stuff really shot on location in apartments that people actually lived in. You get like wonderful images of what New York looked like at that time. So they function as this, on one level, as like a fascinating time capsule of the moment. But blaxploitation is such an excellent example of the kinds of things that trash cinema can do. And that's because trash cinema operates at the boundaries of polite society, right? Mm. It's like tasteless. It can be vulgar. It's outrageous. All of these things, blaxploitation certainly is. But at the same time, because trash cinema operates at the fringes, it can do things that mainstream cinema can't do. So with blaxploitation, even though, you know, it's not like moral cinema, right? It's not like, oh, we should follow all of these, all of the practices that everybody does in these movies. But there are movies where there's actually Black representation at a time that there wasn't, right? So they're a perfect example of how trash cinema can combine this very sort of outrageous approach with a bit of a political edge. So they're just wonderful examples.
And also, Michael mentioned The Toxic Adventure. The other movie that popped into my head when he mentioned that was Evil Dead. These horror films that are on a string of a budget and yet somehow gain over time, a real cult following.
Sure. I mean, The Toxic Avenger is, of course, a Lloyd Kaufman movie. He is the kind of more like 80s, 90s king of really trashy movies, heading up Troma Pictures that just made, I mean, the Troma movies are just like, they're disgusting, right? They're like absolutely disgusting. But he was one, he was a producer in a long line of directors and producers like Herschel Gordon Lewis, like Roger Corman or Larry Cohen, who are kind of like these amazing auteurs of absolute schlock. Right, like that is where Lloyd Kaufman operates, and I love thinking about him not as a kind of standalone figure, but as somebody who took inspiration from these other folks. Again, Roger Corman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, of course, who directs Blood Feast in 1963, which is one of my favorite trashy movies. It is trashy to the extreme. So, yeah,
Blood Feast. Let's go now to Kim in Brookfield. Kim, good afternoon. I understand you've seen Cocaine Bear.
Yes, I have seen it. My husband and I went to see it last week.
And?
Two weeks ago. Honestly, I was wondering where Hollywood's going with this. You know, we were deceptive. It was very deceptive, the advertising for it. We just thought it'd be kind of like thrilling, whatever. I found it to be very, very gory, extremely gory. I was also a little taken back by the fact that there were like 12-year-old kids that were using language inappropriately, trying drugs. Hmm. And even though it was kind of funny that they did it in a, not the way that, you know, whatever is supposed to be kind of funny, I don't think it was funny. I just kind of felt like they were promoting some really bad ideas. And we looked at each other like, when are we walking out? And we just kind of sat there thinking, oh, it's going to get better. It might get, there might be a plot. I don't know. But, and I really don't know if it was really based on a true story. I mean, none of that was really too real except for the bear ate.
Yeah. It sounds like you were a little disappointed by the film, Kim. And is part of this the marketing of Cocaine Bear, that it wasn't on the fringes, that it was on the big screen, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the problem is here, because when I teach trash cinema, we're not really watching movies that were extremely popular. They're really more cult movies. Yeah. It was something I found kind of mystifying in the marketing for Cocaine Bear, because it's trying to sort of walk this tightrope where it's, you know, it's got like a pretty good budget. It has to make back that $35 million. That's a lot of money to try to make back. So you have to bring in larger audiences, but then it's also trading on more kind of cult iconography, things like things that are shocking, right? Trash cinema deals in shock. That is its main calling card. So I was actually a little bit surprised by how this film was promoted. I think often when we come away from a movie thinking that something was wrong with it, often it's that it didn't meet the expectations that it promised to give us. So I was a bit mystified by that myself.
We're talking about trashy movies and your favorite trashy movies with UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Kim, thank you for your call. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. She's a film professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called Trash Cinema. And that's exactly where we're focusing our attention this afternoon. With us today to talk about the recent success of the movie Cocaine Bear and the long history of bad films that we can't get enough of. And we're taking your suggestions and your favorites at 1-800-642-1234, where Karen and Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Karen.
Hi. My family's favorite is the original The Highlander.
Yeah.
Very dark as far as cinematography. You can barely see what's going on. The acting is atrocious. There's hardly any dialogue, and the premise of immortals that can only be killed if you cut off their head, and the last mortals, immortals that face off to each other, get all of the power that's been accumulated. And then they did, I think, two follow-ups on that, which were really bad. And then they did a series that was, they tried to clean it up a bit. But it's a family favorite. We go to it. We bought a copy of it, and it was still very, there was no lighting or anything like that. Everything was really shot in dark, shady hues. But my husband and I were on Netflix the other day, and they had it on, and we watched it, and they have gone back in and re-edited it.
Oh.
They lightened it up, and they added some scenes that were deleted. Oh. And, of course, the soundtrack is with, Queen. So there's some pretty good songs. But it's still a pretty bad movie.
Karen, I thank you very much. That's a Sean Connery flick, isn't it, Jocelyn?
It is, yeah. And I thought there could be only one, but that's a Highlander quote.
Nice.
I'm so glad to hear a shout out to the bad acting of trash cinema, because that really is a hallmark, right? We really notice the unprofessionalism when we see amateurish actors. And I kind of love watching bad actors in trashy films, because they speak to the way that trash cinema breaks apart the illusion of film, right? It's like we watch something that's this bad and maybe we laugh at it, but I think one of the things that we find kind of uncomfortable, and that therefore I find actually really generative and interesting, is that We no longer are completely immersed in this filmic illusion. Instead, we're starting to see real people. And that's when things start to get really weird and confusing. And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about trash cinema.
Could we add, since she mentioned the Queen soundtrack, could we add Flash Gordon to that? That's what made me think of it.
Oh, definitely.
Not the best acting there either. Let's go now to Lucas in Jefferson, who joins us at 1-800-642-1234 with one of his favorite trashy movies. What do you have, Lucas?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So in college, I was introduced to the subgenre of trashy movies, trashy like horror films or slasher films. And so my favorite was actually, it's called Thanksgiving. And it reverberates around a turkey that gets brought to life and goes about exacting revenge on people who eat turkeys.
Now, why didn't I think of that? Long before it was Cocaine Bear, it was Revenge Turkey Thanksgiving. Are you familiar, Jocelyn?
Yes, but
really,
that really, can I just talk about one of my favorites then? Because it really makes me think about one of my favorites.
Yes, please.
If we're in this theme of like eating and trashy movies, or like the revenge of the thing that you're supposed to enjoy, especially as a good American consumer.
Yeah.
From 1985, Larry Cohen's The Stuff, which is about ice cream that kills people that eat it. But it's so amazing because in the beginning, like, I can barely talk about this without like laughing my face off. It's so funny. In the very beginning, there's a bunch of miners who just kind of come across this stuff bubbling out of the earth, and then they start eating it and realize it tastes good. And that's just the opening of the movie. It's just wonderful, but it's also a satire of American consumption habits, right? Like how what we eat actually like consumes us from the inside. But it's just wonderful. It's wonderful. It would make a great double bill with Thanksgiving.
Speaking of double bill, let's go now to Gary in Milwaukee, who joins us. Gary, do you have a trashy movie for us?
Well, I mean, I have a question. Yeah. I go back to the 1970s for this, but I'm wondering if the early 1970s, I'm wondering if some of these trashy films were reserved just for the unique environment of an outdoor theater. I'm thinking of one in particular, The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. It was so bad, but so good. And there's also Frogs, Phantasm. I mean, these movies, when I left the theater or drove out of the movie theater, I mean, I felt like I had damaged the way I perceived the world. It was such an experience to watch these things, and they were horrible, but I never forgot them.
And now
just for the outdoor theater.
Yeah, I'll never forget The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, Gary, so thank you. And yeah, the old drive-ins, Jocelyn, and how it really didn't matter what was showing on the screen. It was about the event, the occasion, the evening, to just go somewhere and do something. How much do the old, since we don't see them so much anymore, the old drive-in play a role in the rise of trashy movies?
Oh my gosh, so much in the 70s, especially, right? Because you can have these kind of late night showings at the drive-in. They have to sort of fill time. I love the example of Phantasm, which is such a bonkers movie, and it's a labor of love for Don Coscarelli, right? It doesn't quite work, but it just sticks with you. And the drive-in, yeah, that's such an important aspect. The other important kind of place to think about for 1970s trashy movies is a kind of companion to the drive-in. It would be a kind of like smaller theater that participated in midnight movies. And midnight movies, they were shown since before World War II. This was an kind of off and on thing that theaters did, but it really became popular in the 1970s. And there's one theater in particular, the Elgin Theater in New York, that really popularized showing kind of outlandish, trashy movies, starting with like El Topo, John Waters movies, all these kinds of sort of shocking movies that they would show at midnight and advertise thusly. And part of the appeal was that you would go to this kind of like punk rock situation and meet all of these fellow weirdos, right, watching these movies together. And I think it just speaks to how much the experience of where you're seeing those trashy movies translates to a deeper memory and a deeper kind of interest in them.
Well, our technical director brought up Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's exactly what I thought you were describing there, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example that really, I mean, that movie has had such a sustained audience for so long because of how it's shown and because of how people participate, right? Yeah. It's only partially the movie. It's so much about the enjoyment that people have of getting together and experiencing it together.
Well, Jocelyn, I believe we're going to have to revisit this on another occasion because there is a lot more trashy movies out there than we have time for this afternoon, and a lot more that people really love, enjoy, and go back to again. So I thank you so much for sharing them with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. Trash forever.
I'm with you. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. With us today to discuss why we love bad, trashy movies like the latest hit, Cocaine Bear. Thanks to everybody who called in and joined the show, and sorry to everybody who called in and we ran out of time for. I have no doubt we'll be revisiting this on another occasion. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin's young voter turnout led the nation in last November's elections. Rob Ferret will be back to explore what Wisconsin's doing differently and what's driving young voters to the polls. And also tomorrow morning, Rob speaks with the author of Hot and Bothered, What No One Else Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. It's coming up tomorrow.